thanks so much for being with us. It has been a tremendous weekend in the life of Bethlehem Church. Hope all is well as you. With you, we are always honored when we open and we gather at both of our campuses here, 211. If you're watching online, it's always an honor that you join, that you be part of the Bethlehem family, the Bethlehem team, and where God has placed you. You've put down roots with us, and so we're just blessed by that. So good you're here. Do this because I think God has something for us all. Look at the person that you came with and say, God's got something for me. Say it right quick. God's got something for me. Now, I want you to look at them and mean it and say, God's really got something for you. God's really got something for you. The series we've been in is called Generation. And the question, the word that we've kind of been kind of hanging around has been this word faithfulness. And really the lens that I've been asking, wherever you're at in journey, is what does faithfulness look like? And what I mean by this is faithfulness informed by the life of Jesus and the scriptures that form us, or is it more informed by the culture in which we live? Is faithfulness a moving target? And the reality is we're all products. You've heard this statement before. This is not revolutionary or new to Jason, but we are all products of our environment. Or you've heard somebody say they're a product of their environment. He or she is a product of their environment. Now, a person's environment, or the word I use at times is culture, is not something that we define, it's something that we experience. Think about that. Like, you don't know dysfunction when you're in dysfunction, you just call it norm. It's your norm. It's your culture. It's your environment. That's the idea behind it. The best definition or the best way I've heard to understand the power of a person's culture or a power of a person's environment is the idea of a fish. The fish doesn't know how much he needs water until you take him out of the fish, or out of the water, right? A fish doesn't know how much he needs water until you take him out of it. And when you take him out of it, he's sucking for oxygen, he's sucking for air, and he's like, what's going on? Well, he's out of water. He's out of his normal environment. And with that in mind, Paul writes young Timothy, his pupil, his mentee, his protege, as he's passing on the baton of ministry, as Timothy's pastoring in Ephesus, and he tells him about the environment that is and the environments that to come, the culture that he's going to do ministry in. And he writes him, and he says these words. In fact, I want to hop right to the text, 2 Timothy chapter 3. Here's what Paul says, but understand this, that in the last days there will come times of difficulty. Let me take a pause for a second. Let me give you a little preacher trick here. Don't tell anybody I told you. You want to fill a room up? You want to have a series that everybody's talking about? Let me give you a little preacher trick. Talk about the end of times in the last days. Everybody will get on edge, and everybody will get on the edge of their seat because, listen, no doubt our hope's not only built on the resurrection of Jesus, but we actually believe Jesus is coming again for his church. So that's our hope. But you want to get like people on edge and people talking. You say, hey, we're going to do a series about last days, about the end of times. And when we think that way, we think the book of Revelation. We think prophetic symbols. We think apocalyptic literature where it's like way out there, right? We're trying to figure out what it means. We think what's going on in Russia, what's going on in China, what's happening in the Middle East. We think Antichrist, Mark of the Beast. And so all these things come up. Some of us think these like bad B-rated Christian movies, right? That we saw growing up. It's like, that's what the end of times is. I've seen it. Left Behind, right? And it's like, man, we remember that. But Paul doesn't do that. He goes a completely different way. And he talks about the practical nature of how people will relate with each other and what he refers to as the last days. Here's what he says. For people will be lovers of self. They will be lovers of money, proud, arrogant, abusive, disobedient to their parents, ungrateful, unholy, heartless, unappeasable, slanderous, without self-control, brutal, not loving, good, treacherous, reckless, swollen with conceit. Here's the key word, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Having the appearance of godliness but denying its power, avoid such people. So here's what Paul's telling Timothy. Like the pervasive thought of the day will affect the people of God. Like people will be lovers of themselves. They'll be lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. But that will have an effect on the people of God. It's what he's telling young Timothy. And he hears that the culture, you're ministering, it will buy it hook, line, and sinker. Let me tell you why, because they will claim to have godliness, but they just won't experience the power of it. It will affect the church, the people of God, because they will claim to have a form, an appearance of godliness, but the power won't be seen. Why? Because they bought into the narrative of the day. So he continues on. For among them are those who creep into households, capture weak women, burdened with sins and led astray by various passions, always learning and never able to arrive at the knowledge of truth. Just as Jannes and Jambres opposed Moses, I'll come back to those guys later on. So these men also oppose the truth. Men corrupted in mind and disqualified regarding the faith. But they'll not get very far, for their folly will be plain to all as it was to those men. So there will be many people that will capitalize on this idea of being a lover of themselves. And they'll portray themselves as teachers, but they'll be actually false teacher. And here's the two key phrases. Tonight I'm going to do Bible Teaching 101 and kind of walk you through what God's taught me over the last 2 years in my own life, in my own journey. And it really comes from this thought that Paul lays out. But if you're visiting with us, there's notes on your back, you're going to want these, because I'm going to give you a lot to think and process and talk about. And even though we're not in the middle of small groups, you'll be having a conversation on your way home if you'll let the Spirit of God to allow that. Now, here's the two key words he uses, two key phrases. These are not in your notes, but this is what kind of sets the whole passage in context. People will be lovers of self, and then this one right here. People will be lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Those are the two, and then basically that's the two phrases he kind of mounts everything on. When the love of God is replaced with love of self, all type of vices inevitably follow. Paul just listed out some of those vices. And I put this in your notes to kind of get us thinking tonight. Like, our journey, the Christian life, is a love story. For God so loved the world, John 3:16, that God loved you, that God is love. And that he created you to be loved and to love. It's the essence of the Christian story. And for us, the question that we wrestle with, the struggle that we experience daily, is found in who, what, and how we love. We're made to love, and we're made for love. But for us, the question that we decide daily in our lives, in our jobs, as parents, as students, is who, what, and how we love. Who, what, and how we love. Now, here's the interesting thing. You and I, the invitation and expectation of the environment we live in, our society that we don't recognize, we call it normal because we're products of our environment, is the love of self above all. Like last week, Mother's Day, we said this, life is simplified when you think of life as a dash right here. Like birth date, death date, when I was born, when I was died, that right there. You don't simplify your life, that's it. And what you will find is the most destructive things, the most harmful you are in other people's lives, and the most destructive choices you make in your own life all come from this ancient fruit called pride. This ancient fruit called pride. Paul says to Timothy, people are lovers of themselves. People will be lovers of themselves. Now, our commitment to self-importance is not new. In this series, Generations, the reality is one of the unique things about life, liberty, and pursuit of justice is we've always been committed to this idea of self-importance. Which isn't bad in and of itself, but you take it to the extreme, it gets interesting. And in the road, David Brooks writes in his book, The Road to Character. He talks about the difference in self-importance and the view of themselves in emerging generations. Look at what he writes. Between 1948 and 1954, psychologists asked more than 10,000 adolescents whether they consider themselves to be a very important person. At that point, so 1948, 1954, 10,000 adolescents, do you consider yourself to be an important person? At that point of the 10,000 survey, 12% said yeah. 12% said yes. The same question was revisited in 1989 when the same survey was given to another group of 10,000 adolescents. No longer was the answer 12%. It was 80% boys and 77% girls, and that was 30 years ago. Imagine what the percentage would be now. Now, there's a ton of reasons why this is. But one of the things up under psychology, and I've got some counselors in the room, so they would probably tell you he's right about this. One of the things under psychology, modern psychology, is we convinced ourselves about 100 years ago that the reason people make bad choices And the reason people make destructive decisions in their own life is because they have a low self-esteem or low self-worth. Now, on many levels, that has some truth to it. But the slippery slope of that thinking and where we become is in our desire to build the self-worth of people, we end up with a society of people who live as if they're the center of the universe. Right? We are convinced of our own awesomeness as a whole. Not you, but as a whole. Now, obviously, as God speaks, obviously, technology, interconnectivity, and so he agrees with me, and social media has amplified that. Let's just be honest, right? So technology, social media, interconnectivity, all we've done is kind of amplify that. Now, before, if you're in the room and you're 45 years and above, before we do the old, well, the kids these days, before we do that, let me give you an interesting stat. The fastest growing demographic among social networks, people engaging in social networks, the fastest growing demographic is people aged over 65. Self-importance is not just an obsession of the young. I'm taking up for you guys, right? It's the dominant shaping of our entire culture. Now, the root of self-importance is this idea of pride. But pride is a broad term. And I think a lot of times we love making pride the punching bag for pastors. Pride, pride, pride. But it's a broad term. So what do you mean? So like think about it. Like if you're a parent of a kid that's grown up and now they're parents, you have pride in your children as they're grown adults following Jesus. There's a pride. You're proud of them for doing that. That's not bad. Like my last name is Britt. I'm proud of my last name, like my father and the family I come from. That's something I take pride in. Is that bad? No. Some of you are proud of the community you were raised in. You take pride in that. Is that bad? No. So we got to kind of simplify pride. Because on the other side, when the preacher brings up pride, here's what we think. I know what he's talking about. Arrogant, cocky, conceited, haughty. I know somebody like that. Right? That's kind of what we think. But the feeling that we get when we do that, like oftentimes, is no doubt I know people like that. Because all of us, when I lay those words out, haughty, arrogant, conceited, we go, oh, I know somebody like that. Anybody know somebody like that? You know what I mean? We all do. But the problem is we let ourselves off the hook because pride is more pervasive than that. And here's what the Lord's been teaching me. And here's kind of the best way I could simplify things. And I put this in your notes. Pride is not thinking too much of myself. Pride is thinking of myself far too much. Pride is not just walking around with a bowed out chest, laying, look at my kids, how great they are, look at how much money I got, look at how I look. That's what we think of when we think of pride. But the reality is the natural instinct to only think about yourself. Listen to me. It's the reflex, the filter of me. Now, just as my arrogance or your arrogance makes life about your accomplishments, your insecurity makes life about your deficiencies and flaws, but the end result is it's still about you. Being boastful is a form of pride, no doubt about it, but so is self-pity. Why? Because it puts you at the center. It puts you at, it's the posture of the heart that removes God from the throne. It doesn't dismiss him, it just relegates him to a part of the story. Right? So is haughtiness or cockiness? Absolutely, thinking yourself too much. But so is insecurity, because you're only thinking about your weaknesses and your deficiencies. But guess what? The end of that thinking is still you. It's not thinking too much of myself. It's the instinct to only think of myself. Now, do I think every person in this room or listening online is prideful? No. Not at all. Do I think we're all self-absorbed? Zero chance. I don't think that at all. Do I think we all have a tendency to wrestle with it? You better believe it, including myself. Why? We're products of our environment. Now we're tracking? We're products of our environment. Now, the best word that describes this is actually not a biblical word. So I'm going to borrow from Greek mythology for a second. But I think when Paul writes in 2 Timothy, to Timothy, and he's talking about what life will be like in the last days, in the end of times. Like I think the best word to describe this perpetual state of pride is this right here, narcissism. In narcissism, all that is pride normalized. Now, let me make sure, if you go to Webster's Dictionary and type in, or go to Google and type in definition of narcissism, that pride normalized is not going to come up. That's Jason's shorthand trying to explain narcissism. It's the perpetual state of being self-absorbed. Now, do you remember back in school when you learned a little Greek mythology about Zeus, Aphrodite? Anybody in your room raise your hand, Greek mythology? Okay, all three of us, good. Well, back in the day, there was this thing that you learned in English class, learning history about Greek mythology. The word narcissism comes from the myth of Narcissus in Greek mythology. Narcissus was a handsome young man who everyone fell in love with, and he scorned everyone who fell in love with him. Then one day he saw his own reflection in a pool of water, and he fell in love with his own image. Again, Greek mythology here. And he became so transfixed by it that he couldn't tear himself away. He slowly starved to death, and he rejected all relationships and people who would try to help him because he was fixated on his image in the water that he saw. At the place of his death, again, Greek mythology, a flower called the Narcissus grew. And it's a story of a cautionary tale about the tragedy of self-obsession. His fixation on himself prevented him from connecting with and loving, being loved by or loving anyone. Today, people aren't looking at their image in the water. We're drowning, staring at our images on screens. Come on. See, I think faithfulness, church, is to choose to go the other way. But notice the word I said was choose. It's going upstream when all of culture goes downstream. If the Christian life is a love story about who, what, and how you love, or who, why, and how we love, or what love looks like in our life, I think the divine opposition to pride or the perpetual state of being self-absorbed is humility. It's the way of Jesus. Jesus says it like this in Matthew 11, "Come to me, all who are weary and burdened, I'm going to give you rest." Look at what he says, "But take my yoke upon you," and what does he say? This is so good. "Learn from me." So humility is learned. Why do you say humility? Because here, look what he says. "For I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls." See, in the last 2 years, as God just works on me just like he works on you in your own life, as God teaches me and kind of opens me up to realities of things I think I figured out and realize there's more depth to it, a prayer I've been praying as your pastor I want you to know about. It's a prayer that's in all of my journals. It's a prayer that I begin every day with. And the prayer goes like this, and I put it, it's not in your notes, but it's on the screen. This is what I pray. "God, grant me the wisdom that exceeds my gifts and the humility that exceeds my platform." So God, in a world that says it's about your gifts and your talents, what you bring to the table, in a world that says it's about your influence and the platform, my prayer that I ask of God is that he would give me wisdom that's way bigger than any talent I have or gift I have. And he would give me humility that's way deeper than any platform he gives, right? Because here's what I've learned. I am most helpful to Bethlehem Church when I choose the path of humility. But I am most destructive to Bethlehem Church, or I should say I am most dangerous to Bethlehem Church when I choose the path of pride, but they are both a choice. So let me kind of as I was trying to get up under pride there and make sure that we redefined it a little bit. It's not just thinking of myself too much, right? That's my posture for thinking of myself too much. All right, thinking I'm something, but it's just the instinct to only think of myself. Here's what I would say on humility. Humility, let me redefine this, is not a state of being, it's a choice. Humility isn't self-depreciating. It isn't low self-esteem. It isn't being a doormat. Jesus was none of those things, and he said, learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart. But Jesus wasn't any of those things. Humility is not letting yourself being taken advantage of or just go with the flow because you're a nice guy or a nice gal. Humility is not the, aw, shucks, life's not about me, come on. That's not humility. If you're a parent and you've got young kids in the house, our kids are getting a little older, but boy, they loved, back when they were little, they loved Winnie the Pooh. Humility's not Winnie's best friend, Eeyore. Eeyore was the donkey that walked around with a thumbtack in his fanny holding his tail on. You know what I mean? I said fanny, in his tail, right? Here's what Eeyore did. Woe is me, Pooh. Life's bad. Things are awful. I don't know what I'm going to do. I would contend Eeyore was a narcissist, but that's neither here nor there, okay? Because he was only thinking of himself. But it's a choice. Jesus' kid brother, James, said, humble yourselves before the Lord and he will lift you up. It's the polar opposite of pride. And Jesus says, learn from me. And so Paul in Philippians gives us this famed 5 or 6 verses describing how Jesus, if he said, learn from me because I'm humble, the choice Jesus made, because humility is not just this state of being. It's a choice. It's not just something you think in your head, oh, I'm humble. That's not the way it works. It's not the aw shucks. But look at what Paul says in Philippians 2. Have this mind among yourselves, which is yours in Christ Jesus, who though, speaking of Jesus, he was in the form of God, that's big, he didn't count equality with God a thing to be grasped. That's so cute. Listen, here's what I want you to put down. Based on the life of Jesus, when it comes to humility, and us grabbing this idea that goes upstream in a self-absorbed culture, listen to me. True humility has a sense of your own worth and abilities. Has a healthy sense of your own worth and abilities. Here's what Paul just said. Jesus was God. He was not confused that he was God. He knew he was God. So all the characteristics and all the attributes you want to throw and hurl and worship at God, that was true of Jesus. He knew that was who he was. That was in question. Yet, he chose servanthood. So Jesus knew his worth. Jesus knew his ability. See, humility presupposes dignity. What I mean by that is confident. A humble person, true humility, is confident in its own intrinsic worth and abilities. It's not always looking for it. In fact, I would contend one of the most misunderstood things about humility is unless you have a healthy sense of your own personal worth and your own abilities, I think it's impossible to be humble without that. Like in a stream of our culture that says you are what you do, you are what you have, and you are what people say you are. If you believe that, we hop into this culture and say, what are we always trying to do? Prove our worth by what we do. Prove our worth by what we have. Prove our abilities by what people think about us. But the Bible teaches fundamentally that you and I have intrinsic worth and value just as we are. That he wires you up, that you have to be convinced of that, to choose humility. Jesus knew he was God. He knew at any moment he could snap his fingers. And the life that he was living for us could end. But he chose to go to the path of a servant. I read a story about in the 1930s, three guys get on a train in Detroit. And they walked to the back of a train late one night, and they decided there was a guy sitting back there by themselves, so I don't know if they were inebriated or just bullies. I'm not sure what was going on. But they decided to themselves, this is in the 1930s, they walked to the back of the train, and they said, we're going to pick on this guy. So they began hurling insults at this lone guy sitting in the back of the train. He didn't do anything, just sat there. They turned up the heat on the insults. He didn't say anything. They kept at it and kept at it and kept at it. Finally, the train came to its destination. And this man who these three guys have been hurling insults stood up. And when he stood up, he was bigger than they thought he was. And he reached in his pocket, and he pulled out a business card, and he handed it to these three guys. And on that business card, here's what it said. Joe Lewis, boxer. Joe Lewis, from 1937 to 1949, was the heavyweight boxing champion of the world. So as he got up, handed him a card, and walked off the train, these three guys all gathered around the card to see who this was, and it said, Joe Lewis, boxer. From 1937 to 1949, he was the world heavyweight champion of the world. The International Boxing Research Organization says he's the greatest boxer to ever live. Second was Muhammad Ali. It is said of Joe Lewis that he could knock out a horse with a punch. Now, I don't know how I figured that out, right? I'm not sure how, but the horse must have done something, okay? But the dude was a bad man. Joe Lewis didn't need to prove to these guys his worth and ability. He knew it. He didn't have anything to prove to these three little knuckleheads. In a second, he could have stood up and taken all three of them out. But humility's got nothing to prove. God created you with extreme worth and value. You're made in the image of God. He gifted you. He wired you. I say that once every 6 weeks. You're a work of God. You're His beloved. Here's why I say that, because everything else in our culture says you are what you do, you are what people think you are, and you are what you have. You have nothing to prove. Jesus knew He was God. That was never a question. True humility knows internally, intrinsically, it has worth and it has value, or He has value and He has worth. Abilities. Listen to me. Philippians 2:7, you keep moving. It says this, but Jesus made Himself nothing. So He knew He was God, but He made Himself nothing. He took on the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. So He knew He was God, but He took on the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. Write this down. True humility is willing. It's a choice. Go back to what I said. It's willing. It's fundamentally exampled by Jesus. He made a choice. There's another form of the word humility that we don't often talk about, and that's humiliation. See, if you've ever had a 3 or 4 year old in a line at Target, in the line at Walmart, in the line at Publix or Ingles, and you're standing in line minding your own business, and that 3 or 4 year old, maybe 2 or 3 year old, goes, Mommy, why in the world does her hair look like that? You know what I'm saying? You want to go, oh, goodness. Right? Our mom, why is he wearing that? Anybody been there? Is that just my family? Okay, thank you. You're all like, oh gosh, that's your kids. Yeah, they did it all the time, you know, and would just embarrass you. But again, listen to me. At some point, all of us have felt humiliation for something we did, for something we said, or for something we should have done and we didn't. And every time in my life, I've thought, oh my gosh. Because something's been exposed, something I did or I didn't do. Here's the reality. If I would have chosen to humble myself along the way, that point would have never come. See, I cannot tell you how many times I've sat in conversations with people in my 20 years of ministry whose marriage is on the ropes and at the end, whose family's breaking up, who's in a cycle of making bad choices and everything's beginning to fall apart, and they are humiliated. They're embarrassed about where their life has come. They're broken and they hate it. And the reality is, along the way, if somebody would have chosen the path of humility, they would have never gotten here. They would have never gotten here. See, listen to me, church. You know this. Life has a way of humbling us that's called humiliation. Or we can choose the path of humility that's called faithfulness. Sooner or later, we all experience it. How many times in the Gospels did Jesus perform a miracle? And when He would perform a miracle, everybody would be going, where's Jesus? We want to celebrate Him. But what did the Gospels say? He went off because it wasn't yet His time. How many times Or I should say, how many times? How about the picture in the gospel where Jesus, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords, washes his disciples' feet? Should they not have been washing his feet? He made a choice. In the Garden of Gethsemane, the night before he goes to the cross. If there's any other way this can pass for me, if I don't have to go to the cross, if we can figure out the redemption of mankind some other way, let that happen. But yet not my will, but yours. It's a choice. And then Philippians, here's what Paul says. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross. So if humility is convinced, doesn't need proving, it knows it has worth, it knows it has abilities. If humility at the end of the day is willing, it's a choice. It's something we step into, not just a state of being, not just our mind. It's a choice, it's willing. Here's what I would say. True humility based on the life of Christ is social. Now that sounds anticlimactic, by the way, I just built that up. But let me explain. Because here's where I think fundamentally we miss it. It's not a private act of self-deprecation or a refusal to talk about your accomplishments. Oh man, no, you know. That's called modesty. Humility is about the redirection of your powers, whether physical, intellectual, financial, right, for the sake of others. Humility always plays out in relationship. Here's what that means right here. You don't get to think in your head, man, I'm humble. People will tell you if you're humble. You don't get to think in your head, woo, man, I got this humility thing. I got it licked. Not the way it works. People feel it. Humility is not something we proclaim. Humility is something people experience in us. Experience in us. What do you mean? It's the dad who chooses for a season to lay down things in his life that he enjoys doing to be at home with his wife and kids more. It's him redirecting his power for the sake of others. It's the dad who chooses to come home from work instead of chasing the almighty dollar at 5 o'clock or 5:30, even though he can make some more money and make some more profit, right? He chooses to come home. He uses his influence. He redirects it for the power and the sake of others. It's the mom that for a season of her life puts her ambitions, her dreams, and her desires on a shelf for a season and uses her influence and redirects it for the sake of others, her children. It's humility. It's a choice we make. It's the spouse who love their husbands or love their wives, and they choose to redirect their resources. Often they give up their personal preference, their financial independence, and they give up their autonomy to see their spouses thrive. It's the redirection of our power for the sake of others. It's the church that redirects its influence, not for those in the walls, but for those that will never experience what happens in these halls. It's the leader, it's the business owner, it's the influencer who uses his influence, who uses his money, who uses his finances, who uses his success, not just for a house at the beach, not just for a bigger car, not just for a bigger house, but he uses his influence, he redirects it for the sake of others. It's a choice we make. God himself redirects his power, redirects his influence for the rescue of a lost and broken world. He used his power to write himself into the story of human history, to do for us what we could not do for ourselves. Then gifted victory to us. Humility is conformity to the image of Christ Jesus. Humility is social. It's experienced in relationship with others. In fact, what God's had to redefine in my own life in the last 2 years, because God's been changing my understanding of humility, because oftentimes I'm like you. I hear humility and I have church speak and Christianese that ring in my ear, which means just somebody who walks around going, life's not about me. Life is not about me is a statement. Choosing humility is a life. right? It's the guy, it's realizing what the biblical picture of humility is, because here's what I found. Humility, right, is more about how I treat others than how I think about myself. You need to circle this. You need to star it, the little doodles you draw while I'm talking. You need to put one right around this on your paper, right? Because listen to me, this is everything. Humility's more about how people experience me than how I think about myself. Pride's a choice, humility's a choice, and there's a fine line. God has reminded me again and again that we all walk. Like, think about it. It's a fine line. Like, I believe my calling in this season of my life, I'm here to serve you. So I teach you the scriptures. I'm here to help you and to serve you, to encourage you, to challenge you. But do you know the fine line of pride? It screams in my ear, no, they're here to hear you. I have to choose which one I walk out in. Am I here for you or are you here for me? That's all of our life. Am I here for you or are you here for me? In a self-absorbed culture, oftentimes we get caught in that. Humility is more felt by people than it is claimed by ourselves. You've heard the statement, man, he's so humble, wait, he'll tell you about it. You know what I'm saying? They're so humble, just wait, they'll tell you about it. All right, because we all I'm saying tonight for us, I think the road less traveled is the daily choice to say, no. It's taking everything I have for the sake of others in a self-absorbed culture. Now, as we close, he mentions, Paul, these two names I want to end with, Jannes and Jambres. I mean, just random names. Is the Bible not just full of random names? Come on, you know what I mean? I'm smiling here. I'm a pastor. I can say that. You're like, no, they're biblical. Well, they're random, okay? Right? No doubt they're biblical, but they're just random. It's like, okay, Jannes and Jambres, you know. All right, so you sit there and you go, well, why does Paul bring these guys up? He's talking about how things will be. Then he goes, oh, yeah, remember Jannes and Jambres? And I think to myself, no, I don't remember them. You did too, just be honest. I don't even know what he's talking about. Come on. Well, I think he makes a great point, and I've always missed it. He writes to Timothy and goes, hey, there's an allure to being self-absorbed. There's an allure to being a lover of yourself. There's an allure to loving pleasure rather than loving of God. That's why it affects the church. There's an allure to it. And then he uses Jannes and Jambres, and he talks about Moses in the same context. Now, Moses' story is in the Old Testament. And Moses, God used to rescue the people of Israel out of captivity from Egypt. Pharaoh was the king, the prince, the kind of leader, if you will, of Egypt at this time, the royalty. So Moses, with his problem of speech and unsure of himself, goes before Pharaoh and says, God wants to free his people. His people are Israel. He wants to free them. Exodus 1 through 20. You can read the whole thing right here. I'm giving you a short snapshot. And if you don't free them, there will be consequences. You heard about it in Sunday school, the 10 plagues. So here's what Pharaoh does, Exodus chapter 7. As he listens, he goes, nah, I hear what you're saying, but I'm not sure I buy it. So Moses throws a rod on the ground, and it turns into a snake. And so Pharaoh says, hey, get Jannes and Jambres. Who are they? His magicians. And he goes, show them what you got, boys. They throw staff down, turns into a snake. And this continues on, and here's what Jannes and Jambres do. They play a game of anything you can do, we can do better. Anything you can do, we can do better. And here's how Paul ends to Timothy. He says, the reality is the allure of self-absorption, the allure of being a lover of ourselves. Why people are drawn to that is because in that culture, here's what happens. The scripture offers abundance, but so does the culture. The scriptures offer life and joy and peace, following Jesus, a joy that exudes out of you, a peace that you can't explain. But wait. No. Anything you can do, I can do better, and so does our culture. So does our society. Oh, yeah. No, I hear, Pharaoh, I got you. God's way, I'm with you, but I can get the same thing over here. And that's the allure of our culture. That what the Scripture promises, we package a whole different way and say, but everything they say, man, listen. And here's what Paul ends. These guys' ways was fraudulent, and it was showed when the whole nation was wiped out. You choose the path of humility, the road less traveled. There's an allure to just going along in the stream with everything else. But as mothers, as fathers, as students in the room, as college students, as single adults, there's a path of humility. It's convinced of its worth. It's convinced of its abilities. Humility's willing. It's a choice. It's not just a thought you have, man, I'm humble. That's not the way it works. Based on the life of Jesus. And it's experienced more than it's proclaimed.